What a pleasure this morning to be joined by two visiting couples, my in-laws, Mac and Linda, who have been with us before, and next Sunday's guest preacher, Tim Taylor, and his wife Yvonne. A great day to have you all with us. We look forward to getting to know Tim and Yvonne during our fellowship meal. That's part of the plan of why they're here ahead of the time. A great idea, I think. And something else makes this a very special day as we come to this particular passage. These are the verses that I spoke from on the evening that our son Nathan was baptized. I don't know if that occurred to you this morning as you came and saw what we were going to be dealing with. It is hard to believe that it has already been a dozen years or so since that event, that joyful event. We still thank God for it, and I'll be coming back at the end of things in this message to that anniversary, as it were. I'm going to be doing a running commentary of our verses today, applying as we go along, although there will be some things said at the end, rather than separating these matters into the three sections that we've been using so far in this study of Judges. Typical format has been the explanation, the harmonization, then the application, and that's fine. It's good to have a plan. Sometimes it's also good to kind of throw the plan aside and just go with how you feel the Lord wants you to present the information. And so we'll just run along. And what I think jumps out to us today is how bizarre God's instructions can appear to be at times. Remember that we left Gideon just as he had been told that he must attack more than 135,000 enemy troops with 300 men whose main qualification was that they drank like dogs. That talent is perhaps not immediately reassuring as far as fitness for fighting. But as night falls on the very day of this strange test by water that we dealt with last time, the Lord comes to Gideon once again. Chris just read verses 9 through 12. We won't read those again, but this is where we are. As matters continue to go forward in a hurry for Gideon, the Lord knows that the more time he has to think about this and worry about it, the more doubtful Gideon will become of the outcome of this looming battle. He knows he's asking a lot of this young man. He's had to come a long way in a very short amount of time. So he tells Gideon to arise, because tonight is the night for victory. But even here, his command is laced with mercy and understanding. Despite the unconditional promise of success, and God's given that more than once, God gives a further opportunity for Gideon's confidence to grow. He says, if you are afraid. Okay, well, we know that that means since you are still afraid. God knew that fear was still lingering in this man. He knew that he would indeed take advantage of any offer of additional strengthening. Yeah. We usually are that way too. Lord, any additional encouragement you want to give, I'm all ears. Go ahead. And so he hears these words about going down to the outskirts of the enemy camp. And he needs no further prompting. Immediately, he's on his way down to the Midianite camp with his servant, wondering what he might hear. What could he possibly hear that would encourage him so strongly? This in itself strikes me as a little bit humorous. Here, Gideon is fearful about attacking the Midianites. But when he's told that, you know, something could happen that would hearten him for his task, he's willing to do something that I think would take a fair amount of bravery in and of itself. He goes down with only one other person right up to the outposts of this huge army. He's close enough to where he can actually hear the sentries of the other army talking. I mean, you would figure, well, I could be discovered at any time. And if I am, well, that would really do it. But is it not true that sometimes curiosity takes us where faith alone won't take us? He really wants to find out what is it that the Lord has prepared here. So let's read verses 13 and 14 again to find out what it is that he heard there. When Gideon came, behold, a man was relating a dream to his friend. And he said, behold, I had a dream. A loaf of barley bread was tumbling into the camp of Midian, and it came to the tent and struck it so that it fell and turned it upside down so that the tent lay flat. His friend replied, this is nothing less than the sword of Gideon, the son of Joash, a man of Israel. God has given Midian and all the camp into his hand. God has orchestrated this perfectly. I've told you many times the impatience I have when people talk about it. Well, yeah, God is sovereign over the big things. You know, the really big things, the big picture, but not, you know, he's not into all the little details. You know, free will, baby. You know, we do all this stuff and really it ends up being pretty much everything, you know, but God somehow, he makes the big things where, you know, God caused some unknown Midianite to have a specific dream here. Okay. Brought this dream into his mind while he was asleep. We don't know when this man had this dream. It's possible that he had just come on watch and he'd been sleeping during the afternoon. Get ready for his duty. But he decides to relate the content of this dream at the very moment that Gideon arrives nearby. God has clearly micromanaged this whole situation, okay? He even gets down to the level of a worm in Jonah. You know? God appoints a worm. If he's appointing the worms to eat the plant that then dies, and then God is in charge of all the details. That's how you have the big things, right? Do you have big things without all the details right down to the ground? No. God starts way down there, builds everything up. The dream sounds somewhat ridiculous, as dreams usually do. We all awaken. Something's sort of fresh in our minds. Hey, honey, man, I just really had this strange dream. And then as you start to talk about it, it just gets weirder and weirder. I mean, you almost feel foolish talking about it because it just doesn't make any sense. Well, this was weird, but this one did make sense. A loaf of barley does not knock down a tent. Okay? So that's different. This is something that our minds might come up with after having dinner at that place with the throwed rolls, you know, at Sykeston or whatever, Missouri. Never been there myself. It sounds kind of dangerous, you know, that throwing these missiles at you and so forth. This made me think a little bit about that, but what did this loaf that was thrown represent? This was Israel. the loaf was Israel. Now, that's not very flattering when you come to think about it. In fact, some translate this from the Hebrew as a stale barley loaf. It was gross. I mean, it was kind of moldy. Barley was already the least desirable grain for bread. I mean, you're not hoping that it's barley loaf for dinner, okay? But, you know, if you don't have the wheat or the whatever, it might just be barley. Okay, well, if there's nothing else. But this was, barley loaf was stale to boot. What a great picture of the lowly state of Israel, certainly over the past 7 years, but it never had been much as far as standing strongly for the Lord. Never really would be that much. But the terms for what this loaf accomplished, well, they're very expressive and very impressive. The tent is turned upside down. It's flattened. It's open from the inside out. Did that ever happen on one of your Boy Scout camping trips? Something came along and it just collapsed and turned inside out, you know, whatever. I don't know. Complete collapse. It's interesting that this is the tent. It's not merely a tent. This could be the tent of the military leader that was in view. More likely, this one tent described the whole encampment of the Midianites. Lowly Israel would destroy the might of Midian in this very improbable manner. Have you ever felt like a moldy barley loaf? You know, I have. That's really what I was as far as what I had to bring to changing hearts, changing the world, changing anybody's lives for the better. And to some extent, that's good. I'm not saying it's a bad thing to take a realistic assessment, you know, of who you are naturally and say, this is a pretty moldy barley loaf I've got going here. That's a realistic picture, I think, of our powers and our appeal apart from Christ. But we have missed our calling when we allow that lowliness to paralyze us. God can enable us to knock down everything that's been erected by the enemy. You know, we're pulling down strongholds, are we not? A stale barley loaf? Well, that's more than enough when God is doing the throwing. We can deduce all of this with hindsight, but if Gideon had just heard that dream, oh, this loaf came, it hit the tent, collapsed, I'm not sure how much that would have meant to him. Maybe over time and as he talked with people, he might have kind of said, well, you know, maybe this is what the Lord's saying. What seals the deal are the words of the soldier who hears the dream from the other one. So we got two guys involved here that the Lord's using, two unbelievers. Two people without a clue. One person gives a dream and the other person has these words in response. God causes this man to say what Gideon needs to hear. Did this man have some sort of a supernatural discernment into the meaning of the dream? I suppose that's possible. I don't think that we need to see that here. Some suggest that his interpretation was he was just being sarcastic and it wasn't really a serious prediction. It doesn't strike me as that way. I think the guy was saying, you know what? I think that this is maybe what that really actually means. I think that the Midianites had learned through, you know, their spies or maybe captured Jews or, you know, just through facing this other army, you find out who they are and who's leading them and so forth, one way or another. I think that they knew that Gideon was the leader of this opposing army. They know that he's rallied a significant number of troops from around northern Israel to come to this fight. They probably have even heard that the Jewish God had been showing him some remarkable signs. They certainly had seen the people disappearing. They must have been wondering what's going on here. We've never heard of an enemy approaching us this way. I think that there was some conversation, perhaps, that was going on. But this guy, you know, in the light of all this that's going on, I think he could be reflecting his own superstitious fears, you know, what could happen in the imminent battle, considering, you know, they paid a lot of attention to dreams and omens and things like that, okay? So he's saying, you know, I think I know what this means. Whatever this man's insights were, and it doesn't really matter in the end because the Lord caused him to speak his mind so that Gideon can hear. That was the whole reason that this came about. He wanted Gideon to be comforted. He wanted Gideon to be encouraged. He graciously wanted to help his servant in this way, and so he arranged all of this. And made the meaning for him very clear, and we see his reaction in verses 15 through 18. When Gideon heard the account of the dream and its interpretation, he bowed in worship. He returned to the camp of Israel and said, "Arise, for the Lord has given the camp of Midian into your hands." He divided the 300 men into three companies, and he put trumpets and empty pitchers into the hands of all of them with torches inside the pitchers. He said to them, "Look at me and do likewise. And behold, when I come to the outskirts of the camp, do as I do. When I and all who are with me blow the trumpet, then you also blow the trumpets all around the camp and say, 'For the Lord and for Gideon.'" Gideon's initial response to what he heard is just so important. It was so appropriate. Really, I think if you don't get anything else from this message today, take a close look at what Gideon did right here. What did he do at this moment? Right there, he bowed in worship. He was rightly in awe of the sovereignty and the goodness of God to have provided this confirmation for him in this remarkable way. And he did not put off the reverence that was due to the Lord. He did not put it off. That's what I really want you to see. So often we think, you're like me, I'll get to praising God later. You know, note to self, praise God for what just happened there. I will pray as soon as I have some time. And then I'm really going to thank God. You know, I really need to remember this on Sunday morning when I give God a couple hours of my time. I hope, you know, Lord, please remind me, you know, when I go to church on Sunday to really thank you for some of these good things that have been happening. Now, that's when worship is supposed to happen, right? When you go to church on Sunday morning. Obviously, Gideon was in a situation here where he could have easily justified getting on with the business of defeating the Midianites. He's in the middle of something important here. We can't just have a worship service breakout here in the middle of this. But he does not let that choice moment pass. As the perfect attributes of God are on display right then, he takes the time right then to worship. What a great lesson to us to be worshiping God continually as we encounter his many workings in our lives. Brimming with new confidence, Gideon returns to the hardy band of 300 men to prepare them for the attack. This is hardly a complex battle plan. The reason for the three companies is probably to facilitate getting to stations around the camp. So the few warriors that there are very well spread out. That really makes more sense, right? From a military strategy standpoint. You've whittled all the way down to 300, and now let's separate into three groups of 100 and get, well spread out from each other. Each soldier is issued a regulation trumpet, torch, and pitcher. Out of the big army supply depot there. We've got pitchers. Yeah, we got pitchers. Yeah. No doubt more than a few were wondering, just what kind of deadly work could be done with these items. Thank you. Nice pitcher. This isn't exactly James Bond getting the latest gadget from Q, It's like, oh, okay. Perhaps this was only to be a raid. Maybe they were going to lure some Midianites out with the trumpets, a little trumpet serenade, and they kind of come out to investigate, and then you break the pitcher over the head. And when we're going to set fire to a few of the tents with the torches and then kind of, melt away into the darkness and get ready for the devastation to come. Is that what's going on? Gideon's only real command is that the Jews were to do whatever he did. How did Gideon himself know what to do? It's not really said. I can only assume that God had given him instructions, perhaps when he had spoke to him earlier that night. Well, let's finish today's passage with verses 19 through 22. So Gideon and the 100 men who were with him came to the outskirts of the camp at the beginning of the middle watch, when they had just posted the watch, and they blew the trumpets and smashed the pitchers that were in their hands. When the three companies blew the trumpets and broke the pitchers, they held the torches in their left hands and the trumpets in their right hands for blowing, and cried, "A sword for the Lord and for Gideon." Each stood in his place around the camp. And all the army ran, crying out as they fled. When they blew 300 trumpets, the Lord set the sword of one against another, even throughout the whole army. And the army fled as far as Beth Shittah toward Zerera, as far as the edge of Abel Meholah by Tabith. And I'm sure you know exactly where we're talking about right there. That just locked it in for you. They ran away. Well, Gideon leads one of the three companies down to the outskirts of the camp. Again, he's acting by night, but this time it's by the command of the Lord. The darkness was part of God's plan of instilling complete terror into the hearts of the Midianites. Other factors add to the confusion that's about to take place. The small number of Jews allows them certainly to approach in silence. Surprise is complete. The assault occurs after 10 o'clock, which catches the enemy in a groggy state. That might not seem very late to us, but back then most people would have been asleep at 10 o'clock. Also, since the guard had just changed, some were not settled and others were heading through the camp to their tents. Well, that becomes important that it's kind of at the change of a watch time. That wasn't by mistake. And these would be the first to be cut down. It's a little bit saddening, perhaps, to think of the two who had been discussing the dream and encouraging Gideon, never reaching their beds. But only a little sad. Only a little. When Gideon and his fellows act, the assault is more on the senses of the Midianites than anything else. God is just going to use this assault on their senses. Each of these three items plays its part. The pitchers covered the torches until they were ready to be used. Then when they were broken, the sound of that, in addition to the trumpets, would have been startling. It would have been bewildering to them. The Midianites knew that this was definitely not the sound of their own trumpet calls. And as the battle cries of the Jews rang through the camp, it seems clear that they thought there was a large force of the enemy just right in among them in the camp. The shouted names of God and Gideon inspire more fear. Coming out of their tents, the Midianites see the torches that are surrounding the camp. Oh, they must be lighting the way for greater numbers of enemy troops that were now arriving. These are things going on in their minds. And then soldiers loom out of the darkness. Well, they were their own soldiers. But in this confused state of mind, they did not know that. And the Midianites attack them, believing that they are Israelites in among the camp. Soon there's complete mayhem with everyone in the camp trying to, hack his way out to safety through whatever was in front of them. The Jews never move. They just stand there. They simply look on as their enemies massacre each other. Remember that Gideon had wondered back in chapter 6, verse 13, where all the miracles were. Where are all these miracles that we've always heard about? God used to deliver Israel, but now it's over. It's not happening. God doesn't work anymore. By God's grace, he was now seeing perhaps the greatest of them all. The morning light would reveal thousands and thousands of bodies fallen by the hand of the Lord, not by any Israelite army. God had not needed any help in bringing about this result, but he was pleased to use the faith of 300 men following their instructions, 300 human instruments to accomplish his ends in this matter. And they received the blessing, as we were talking about in Sunday school, of seeing God's power to deliver. That's the blessing that we get when we're taken right down to the nub, right down to where it's really become impossible. Well, we will see what happens as Gideon follows up on this route in 2 weeks. 2 weeks is right for the morning. But now we want to conclude by thinking about what this passage reveals to us about living out our faith in the light of what God tells us in his word. On the night that Nathan was baptized, I made the connection between what Gideon and his companions did here and obedience in baptism. Both involve faith that doing something very out of the ordinary will bring blessing. Christ has commanded all who follow him to be baptized. Baptism seems to have fallen a little bit on hard times in the American church, not seen as really all that important. It's really kind of odd how we who pay the least price for standing up in baptism are the ones that you know, have kind of put really so little of a premium on it. Others who know that they could be killed for being baptized have a little different view of its significance. But to many today, what goes on in baptism seems as silly as 301 men attacking 135,000 people with trumpets and pitchers. It's seen as, you know, kind of weird, kind of embarrassing, kind of humiliating. Why do I need to get up there and, you know, go under the water? I don't, you look kind of dumb when you come up. I don't want to look like some kind of drowned rat when I come up out of the you know, we might kind of laugh at stuff, but I'm telling you, this stuff goes on in minds. Well, yes, it is designed to be an act of submission. God knew what he was doing by asking this. It is not for those who prize looking cool, you know, and staying in control, you know, over everything. But to those who understand its meaning, that this is the way that a believer pictures his identification with Christ's death and resurrection, there's only eagerness to comply. I must say, Jesus did not look too cool on the cross. He didn't preserve a lot of dignity on the cross. But we've seemingly advanced much further along, you know, in the way that we need to look. We think of the Ethiopian eunuch who wished to be baptized immediately upon being saved. Hey, here's some water. Let's get this done. Do you not think that that man went back to Ethiopia and had a spiritual impact? Oh, man. Convert that you'd dream about. Nathan had that spirit when he was baptized. We thank God that his level of enthusiasm has continued. It's been evidenced in him through the subsequent years. I always say, you know, you can get baptized, and as far as we know, this is all sincere and everything, but the proof is in the pudding. You know, we'll see what, you know, if this is real, if God is working in your life, and we've seen that. But God has decided to work through various means that seem quite foolish to the human mind. That's what we're being told today. He changes hearts only through an offensive message about a God-man who died on a cross and rose again so that sinful men could be forgiven. Well, that sounds crazy. And you'll know that if you do much sharing of your faith, you'll find yourself, you're saying this to somebody and you're going, you've got to be kidding me. This is how God saves people? By me telling somebody this? Oh yeah, he does. So that means that evangelization that God can bless will depend on taking God at his word on this. But something that seems really foolish is how his power is unleashed. We're told that when we're weak in ourselves, then that's when he is strong. Well, I don't want to really be weak in myself. Yeah. We're told that we should rejoice in our trials because that's how he grows us and that's how he brings good things into our lives, is through trials. We're told that Christ is sufficient for every true need that we have, and that everything that the world holds out to us, you know, for us to find our satisfaction and our security in that's a deception. But it seems foolish sometimes to believe that. Look at what everybody else is doing. We are the true counterculture, are we not? I mean, there's no more radical counterculture than people who are following Christ. Living by faith is just plain crazy. Except for the fact that God has ordained that this is the only way to live a meaningful life that glorifies Him. How wonderful it is that God is patient with us, you know, that He keeps encouraging our faith along.